Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. Well, today I'm very pleased to welcome two people, Sharon Jones and Shirley Geno. Now, they're both from the Severn Hospice in Shrewsbury, and I first came across them because I was listening to the radio one day, and during the course of one of Claire Balding's Ramblings programmes, I heard about the Shrewsbury strollers. So I thought this sounded really interesting because I've had a lot of comfort from walking and talking since I've been bereaved. I think it's really beneficial, but I wanted to learn more about what other people do and how they find it as well. So I contacted the Severn Hospice, and I'm delighted to welcome Sharon and Shirley. So Sharon, can we start with you, because you were the one I first spoke with, and you told me a bit about the background to the strollers, didn't you?
I only joined the organisation about 18 months ago and was astounded really by hearing the stories around how the strollers group was set up. And we do continue to have a regular walking group at the hospice, amongst other different support services connected to bereavement for both adults and children. And during our conversation, I then realised that Shirley was actually here as a volunteer for the hospice way back when the strollers first began. And it's been a huge journey from when the strollers began right through to now. And obviously we've had the pandemic in between, which at the time did put a hold on the strollers group, as it did for a lot of other support networks out there. But it started again when we started to come out of the pandemic, and it's really strong again. You know, we have separate walking groups that run from the Shrewsbury Hospice base, one from the Telford Hospice base. And just hearing the comments from those that attend the walk and the impact that it's had, not only on their ability to learn how to function again after their loss, how to build social networks again, but how to start to create a different kind of normal. And the benefits are so big that it's very much run now by our volunteers. It's self-sufficient, it runs itself almost, but it's incredibly powerful. I've gone on a couple of walks myself as the new manager for this team who oversees the service. I wanted to experience it, myself, and talk to some of those who attend just to really get a feel for the benefits that they get. And it was just so incredibly powerful.
So how do people come? Is it people who've been recently bereaved, or are there some very long-standing members?
What tends to happen at the moment, and Shirley can obviously go back to when the original strollers group started, what we tend to do now when we've worked with a family who've experienced the loss of a family member who's been a hospice patient, after a couple of weeks, we send out some information about the bereavement services that we could offer, which would include an invitation along to the walks with the dates. And they basically then just give consent, let us know that they'd like to come along. If myself as one of the staff are familiar with this particular person, I might meet them on the first day and introduce them to the volunteers. And then it's very much led by the volunteers that lead that group. And people do come back and keep coming back. I think the warmth that everybody shows to each other, that nod of acknowledgement, and people, they all know that they're there for the same reason without not necessarily having to say anything.
I can identify with that, because you don't necessarily want to be curious or nosy, do you? But if you know everybody's there for the same reason at the start, you don't have to ask any questions.
That's it. And I think having the ability to be out in the open in the fresh air, there's no pressure to have to do that, what some people might find really intrusive, you know, those initial conversations, to be able to just gently chat, introduce yourselves. Those conversations then tend to take it, you know, they just come about in a much more natural way, I think.
It's a bit similar to when you talk about talking to teenagers, isn't it? That it's a good idea to do it in the car when you're both facing forward. You don't have to look at each other.
Yeah, they don't like that eye-to-eye contact. It makes people feel uncomfortable, because I think when people sometimes are bereaved, we automatically go into a protective mode of others as well. You know, if somebody says, "How are you feeling today?" what do they actually really want to hear? They probably want us to say, "Yeah, we're actually, I'm okay, thanks." And I think we do go into a natural protective mode, and a fear that they don't really want to hear how we're really feeling.
Only today I was talking to somebody who mentioned that she knew someone who'd been out and bought a very soft piece of flannel to use instead of tissues, because she was worried about other people seeing her tears. That's so sad, isn't it?
Isn't it?
So, yes, you're right. People who are bereaved do try to look after those around them, don't they, and protect them from their pain.
That's it. And I think as bereaved people, we automatically think there is a way that it should be done. Am I doing it okay? Is this normal? When will I stop being so distressed? When will I stop being so angry? And a part of the work that we do, whether it's in face-to-face or on that walking group, it's helping people to recognize that what they're feeling is very normal. We all have very unique journeys through this.
That's the beauty of being part of a group then, isn't it? That you are seeing other people going through what you've been through, but probably at different stages.
That's it. And I think sometimes as well, again, what we tend to see is for somebody who's relatively newly bereaved, to actually see other people who maybe have been bereaved 12, 18 months, to see how they are functioning, how they have maybe gone back to work, how they have gone back or managed to find ways of socializing. It gives them a little bit of hope that actually maybe I might get to where they are. And for those that are a little bit further down in their journey, can look back and think, wow, look how far I've actually come, without really recognizing it or expecting that I would be able to do this again.
That's so true, isn't it? Because we don't really have a chart to measure our own progress with, unless there's someone to compare with, I suppose.
Yeah, but it happens in a very natural way. And you can sometimes just see people looking at each other. And I'd love to just wonder what's going on. What are the questions? But they do, they just get so much support from one another and take a bit of a lead from each other, don't they? So it just happens in a very natural way.
So let's talk to Shirley then about how it all began. Shirley, the very beginnings, can you remember that far back?
I can. It was in 2005. We were doing bereavement groups at that time as well. And one of Sharon's predecessors, I don't know how she even heard about it or thought about it, but she suggested that we start a strollers group. And the first one we ever did was in the Dingle, in the quarry in Shrewsbury. And it would have been the spring of 2005. And there was six people who joined us, seven volunteers. So we certainly outnumbered the people we're helping. And we had one particular gentleman, and he did know it was a strollers group, but he couldn't walk.
Oh.
So, one, bless him, one of us had to sit on a bench with him for the whole of the time. But I think he got something from it, just starting, you know, being part of something that he could be, just be a part of. But, I reiterate actually what Sharon says, and it is that walking side by side, talking out in the fresh air. And we carried it on in the early days. There was many more volunteers than there was people, three people coming along. And then it just seemed to take off. So we started having programs then in the summertime. We would have it every month. It was always a Thursday. And we would walk outside. We had these wonderful people who would pre-walk these places we were going and book places we could eat, because the group and the numbers were just growing and growing. So we'd have all these people, we'd have these lovely people who would have a pub or something and organize and get everybody's food together, and we'd have a lovely walk around the pub area and then come back and have food. And then in the winter time, we'd do events. We'd have quiz nights, games nights, beetle drives, fish and chip suppers. And that was lovely as well, because it was just less formal than the groups that we did on a regular basis. And people could join at any stage. Some people would come once, we'd never see them again. Other people would just keep coming and keep coming. For many years, we had people. And in the end, there would be 30, 40 people coming to our strollers groups. And it was just, I just think it was a huge privilege to be part of listening to people. And I think that was the main thing, just listening, being there for them. I think, which is very important. People just want to offload sometimes.
It obviously worked, didn't it? Or people wouldn't have kept coming back for so long.
That's right, yeah. And I must admit that one, the highlight was Claire Balding coming. I was looking the other day and I have a photograph of Claire and that group that we did on that particular day. And it reminds you of the people who were there. It's just been a huge privilege to be part of that for all those years. It ran from 2005, and I think it stopped just before the pandemic because the people who did a lot of the organising retired. And I think it had run its course, Dillis. I think it had run its course, but as Sharon said, we still have walking groups now.
So this is a phoenix from the ashes, is it really? What made you decide to start it again?
I think, well, I mean, it started just before I joined the organisation, but I think it's always looking at what can we offer. Everybody needs something different. Mm. And what we're trying to do is be as creative as we possibly can. And I think knowing the success of the strollers group, let's try it again. And I think certainly the walk that goes from Shrewsbury once a month, there's about 23 people that regularly attend. Mm. We've recently had contact from somebody who was in the original strollers group who'd lost their partner about 8 years ago that has asked, could they come back? They didn't realise that it's set up again. You know, at the moment, it's manageable with those numbers. I mean, obviously, as services grow, I think we know out there now there's waiting lists for everything, isn't there, in a supportive element. And what we're trying to do is not have those waiting lists. We recognise that actually if somebody is bereaved and they are saying, I need support, they need it timely, it's no good having somebody sit on a waiting list for 2 to 3 months, which was one of the reasons why we set up the most recent bereavement hub, through, you know, recognizing that we'd got quite a substantial waiting list, and we were thinking, how can we reach people in a less formal way, but by offering something so they know that they're being heard, so they know that someone cares, so they know that there's somewhere to go, even if it's just for that normalizing of what they're going through, the recognition of how complex some of the emotions can be and how we never know what's coming next. It's a bit like being on that roller coaster that you sadly can't get off. Mm. And it's proved to be the concept around the hub was let's invite people along, let's have some literature, let's show how the theory works, let's show some models of grief and bereavement so we can actually give them things that you can visualize to take away. We have a complementary therapist that will come in and maybe just do some gentle hand massages to help people just to feel relaxed. If it's their first visit, everybody's very nervous. Occasionally, one of our physiotherapists will come along and do some relaxation breathing techniques for those times where we reach that heightened anxiety or that real distress, to help people to learn some techniques that they can utilize themselves in their own home. So it's just trying to be creative, really, on thinking about what do people need. It's not structured as in it's a sit-down group or one-to-one support, but it's a very gentle way of us introducing bereaved people to each other. But also, it offers the chance for us as the professionals to really assess whether we feel, if we have, you know, heightened concerns about somebody, we can then expedite them up the waiting list for that one-to-one face-to-face support. So it works two ways. It gives us an opportunity to really look at where do we most need to focus our services and our support. And the concept of the hub has, you know, we originally did a pilot. It proved to be so, so beneficial. We have one running in either hospice sites now, and we're just looking at embarking on one for children and families, again, to extend our children and people's bereavement service. So I think it's about being creative and recognizing that everybody's journey is so incredibly unique and we all need different things at different times. You know, I think that's what we're trying to do.
And you call it a hub. Describe it a bit for me. Is this a room where you serve tea and coffee and people can drop in?
Yes, it is. It's exactly what it is, Dennis. It's very informal. So we always know who is, we ask people to let us know who's coming along so we can greet them. If it's their first experience, obviously we can guide them through. Yes, it's very much like an informal bereavement coffee morning, if you like. However, we do a short walk from it. Again, if it feels a little bit overwhelming for people to have the opportunity to get out in the fresh air, to just take that breath and recognize, actually, I'm in a safe space here. Mm. I'm with people who understand. There is no expectation of me to be however I need to be in this moment. And there's no structure, there's no agenda as such. We just monitor who's coming in, but there's always people there who have been a couple of times. And it's surprising how those bereaved people take the new arrivals under their wing. And they form little groups where they'll have a chat. You know, they might set up their own WhatsApp groups. What I found really nice about it, I think sometimes when you think about groups and things like this, it tends to be very female dominated. Whereas we do have quite a lot of gentlemen that come along and really gain something from having that time with us and meeting others in a similar situation. Just being able to just recognize where the difficulties are. The hub runs for about 2.5 hours. If it's too much, if they just want to stay for half an hour, they just want to dip their toe in the water and then leave, that's absolutely fine. There's no expectation they stay for the whole duration. We just try and make it as safe and as informal as we possibly can. There's always a social worker on hand should we have any concerns about anybody. But the volunteers that we have that work with our team are so incredibly committed, experienced, knowledgeable, that they lead the way and are just remarkable at guiding people through their first hub visit, if you like. You know, it's not going to be for everybody, but it was something we thought, you know, let's try it. We tend to run it as, I think we don't want to create a dependency for the people. It's also not just about creating a social network for people. So we do limit the hub visits to 8 per person. But what we do is we do then a sit-down assessment with them and just sort of ask, what have you gained from the hub? Where are the gaps now in your support network? Do you feel you still need some one-to-one support? We also look at what other networks there are maybe in the local community, whether there be church groups or there's little bereavement cafes popping up all over the place at the moment. So we're trying to just link people into things maybe in the community, not to say, you know, I'm sorry, with the hospice, we can't support you, but it's, again, it's that natural journey of when they're ready, taking that step away from the hospice, but still having somebody just there for them. So that's what that was our hope from setting up the hub, is that it would be quite a natural journey without creating any expectations or dependency, and helping people find the gaps in their support. And it's just worked beautifully. Some of the comments that we've had have just been, you know, they give you goosebumps of what people have actually gained from that. And the amount of people that have said, you know what, that's exactly what I needed. I don't feel that I need that one-to-one support now. I've recognised that my pain is through the love that I had for that person. And if I didn't hurt, I'd be concerned, you know? And it's through those conversations and their sharing of their experiences that it's enabling them to reach that natural decision themselves of, this has been enough for me. I think I can now step into that wider world, knowing that, you know, I'm okay, I will be okay, I know where to go if I have a wobble, if I feel I need additional support. I think it helps people to feel an element of gaining a bit of control back over their lives, maybe, because certainly when we lose somebody through illness or sudden death, whatever, that control is taken away, and it helps people to build some control back in their lives, but also empower people to recognise where their needs are, what do they need to be able to continue with the rest of their life without that person who has been a huge part of their life, you know? I think we're constantly learning. We learn. You can read a million textbooks, but it doesn't give you that personal experience that we are learning from these people every day, that we can share with other people to help them through their grief.
And I think sometimes as well, you get a particular bond with some of these people who come through the group. I can remember one particular gentleman who came to a bereavement group in my very early days of doing it, and he just didn't want to talk. I don't want to talk about anything. You could see by his face he was terribly distressed. And it took him a few months of coming to the group before he started opening up about things. And I had this particular bond with him, and it was really special because over the years, and there was a group of them that were called Pals for Life, and they had their own group, and they did an awful lot of fundraising for us. They would have coffee mornings, they raised a lot of money for us, they bought a lot of things for hospice. And then this particular gentleman came in one day, and I was working, and he came to see me, and he said, I just want to speak to you, Shirley. He said, I've just been to the hospital. He said, I've just been diagnosed with cancer. He said, I wanted to share it with you, the first person to share it with. I mean, that is just an incredible moment to think that somebody who'd been a total stranger, you could have this bond with, and they feel that comfortable with you, that they share that with you. And he did actually pass away at the hospice here. So it was like a whole journey.
I think it's about enabling people to feel safe and build that trust. Because when we open up our world, you know, I think as bereaved people, we sort of think, oh, should I still be feeling that? You know, why am I feeling so distressed again today? It's 3-4 years down the line. But that doesn't matter. There's no time frame for this. When we lose somebody, we lose them for the rest of our lives. And it's how we manage that. But I think being able to enable people to feel safe and say it's absolutely okay for you to share your thoughts, your feelings, your anger, your distress. Mm-hmm. You're not going to frighten me. I'm not going to run away. I'm going to stay here mm-hmm. with you.
As you've been talking, I've got this picture of you holding people, almost like a cradle, really, holding them until they're ready to leave or fly off or do other things or venture away.
Yeah, and I think that's part of our role, because people are thrown into such distress. There's no guidebook, is there? I think if we could write a guidebook, how to manage bereavement, you know, it would be a bestseller. But everybody, you know, like I've said a couple of times, everybody's journey is so unique. But I think we do hold people. And I think I always get a real sense of positive achievement when somebody says to me, I feel I'm ready to finish my work with you now.
Yeah.
Because you've enabled them to take that control and recognize themselves that they can continue. Knowing that if they have a fallback, we're here, we're at the end of the phone. But people do naturally reach a point where they say, thanks ever so much for being there for me. I don't think I need the support anymore. And that's when, you know, you can sit back and really get that sense of how privileged it's been to walk a part of that person's journey mm-hmm. with them, but feel able to say, I actually really agree with you. You're doing really, really well. Without that sounding patronizing in any way, you know, it's enabling people to find their own mm-hmm. way through it.
But I think also it says an awful lot about the wonderful stuff that you're doing, all the work that you're doing, says a lot about society in general, because in a way, all these people aren't getting that support from anywhere else, are they?
No. I think it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you know, we try and offer the very best that we can, but everywhere has very limited resources. Okay, there are things online. We know that there are things online, but not everybody is okay with technology. Sometimes people just need somebody to sit with them and be with them in that moment, in that distress, and just listen. Like Shirley said, it's that giving that opportunity for them to say, this is my story and this is the impact that it's had on me and will continue to have on me. But when you go full circle, and you see people's demeanour change completely. You see the light flicker back in their eyes, their whole facial expressions changing through that course of the work that we do. It's really powerful. And I think all of us as a team get so much reward from seeing people when they recognize themselves.
And listening to their stories when we've gone a long way in some of the bereavement groups, and we'll ask them to remember how they met their loved ones in the first place. And those stories have been so powerful. And a lot of them, and I can remember a lot of them, it involved a bicycle. Just after the war or something, they met on bicycles or in shops. And it's just a privilege to listen and hear people's stories. And you can see them when they're telling the stories. It's in their face. They're remembering, going back to those places and remembering exactly how it was to be able to tell you. And it's just such a privilege to be there and listen.
I've been wondering whether people feel okay about coming back to the hospice where their loved ones have died, because that was something I found a big hurdle myself.
Yeah, I think
it is.
Of course it can be. And I think some people want to come back. Those that we can recognise it's difficult, obviously we take them to a safe space within the hospice grounds, but not actually on the hospice ward. We're actually very fortunate. We've got a separate building, our community services building, where we've got beautiful quiet rooms where they don't necessarily have to come to the doors of the ward. You know, they haven't necessarily got to see people in uniform. They haven't necessarily got to walk back that journey again. And, you know, again, that was another reason for creating the hub, because it means that people don't have to go anywhere near the wards. But absolutely, totally understand the difficulty that people will have, because you have all of those memories, the trauma that's connected, and you can relive every moment of when you first come through the hospice doors. And for some people, depending on the time scale, that can just be far too distressing and re-traumatize people. It might be that further down the line, they might then decide, actually, yes, I do want to go back, but there would be no expectation. I think we recognize this has got to be about what feels okay for that person. Mm. And if people never want to come back, that's absolutely okay as well.
So to both of you, Sharon Jones and Shirley Geno, thank you so much for talking to me, and thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing.
Thank you very much, Shirley. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.